Shalom, Shalom. Be Shalom, Shalom. Be Shalom, Shalom. Be Shalom, Shalom. Be Shalom, Shalom.
We believe in
peace. Shalom, Shalom.
We believe in
peace. Shalom, Shalom.
We believe in peace.
Shalom, Shalom.
Welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. That cut opening tonight's show was the music of Emma's Revolution, and that specific piece was called Peace, Shalom, Shalom. Well, turning my attention to the show tonight, at the top of the hour, we have calling in from the UK, Julia Stonehouse, author of Father's Seed, Mother's Sorrow, which is the story of how men came to be thought superior because of a totally wrong idea of science. She'll share her research going back to prehistoric ideas of conception when female is central to the shift of woman as man's baby-making machine. We'll also get into the hostility of archaeologists to these thoughts. Julia is a freelance writer based in the United Kingdom. Also with us tonight, when we cross the threshold in the second half of the show, Anna Dia Judith, world-renowned teacher and best-selling author who's been called a prophet of our time, will discuss her newest book, The Global Heart Awakens. Judith will discuss her theory that humanity is going through a rite of passage from cultural adolescence into planetary adulthood, and chats about who we are, where we come from, and where we're going. So without further delay, let's get right to Julia. First of all, Julia, thanks for staying up in the middle of the night to chat with me.
That's okay, Karen.
Well, let's get started here. Your book that you have out, Father's Seed, Mother's Sorrow, interesting title. Why don't you start by explaining the significance?
I specialize in reproduction theory, which is to say I'm interested in where people think babies come from, the facts of life. And it's an extraordinary fact, Karen, that until the turn of the 20th century, people did not know where babies come from, in the sense, simply, and, you know, very simply, that there was a mother. They thought there was simply a father who planted his seed into the soil of the woman. And that is a very late date, the turn of the 20th century. The history of embryology in the 19th century, you know, they had a lot of experimentation going on. And, you know, this idea of the male seed goes all the way back to at the very earliest 3000 BC, but in some places, you know, much, much later than that, 700 AD. And so I'm interested in that subject, reproduction theory, and also I take that all the way back into prehistory, because once you find out when the idea started, or finished rather, the turn of the 20th century, the idea of the male seed, when did it begin? And then you see an interface with a completely different set of conception ideas, which is that the seed is in the woman.
Mm-hmm.
And even before then, in the Paleolithic, you have the idea that the woman is parthenogenetic, she reproduces on her own. So, you know, already we can see that there are three reproduction theories, aside from our own, which is that there is a father and a mother.
Right.
So, that's my subject.
So it's, you know, these ideas about reproduction, it shifts from one thing to another. I mean, I know in feminist theology, you know, we like to point out that, you know, thousands of years ago, when they didn't understand man's role in reproduction, you know, they just saw that the woman, you know, it was her womb that became filled with life, and she's the one that was the life giver, so to speak. It was a long time before they figured out that, you know, men actually played a part in procreation. And then, yeah, I know, you know, then it becomes the time of patriarchy, and the woman is just the incubator, you know, for the male seed. So, and then by association, woman as life giver, sort of becomes, you know, reduced to no more than, you know, what do you say? You call it the soil, you know, and you know, I'm referring to it as an incubator, and we can sort of point to that as the demise of women's authority, you know, women's spiritual authority, women's cultural authority. Would you say?
Oh, completely. And in fact, it's very interesting you use the word incubator, because my first book on the subject, which came out in 1994, was called Idols to Incubators, because that's what happened, you know. We became incubators. And if you think about it, this is a very, we're talking about 30, 40,000 years of history here, so, you know, it's quite difficult. But when you go right back to the very beginning, you do have the idea that the woman is passing genetic, she reproduces entirely on her own. Once you get to farming, which is 10,000 BC that it begins, people start saying to themselves, well, where's the seed? But they're looking for a singular seed, because we don't take two seeds and squish them together. We know the ovum and sperm fuse. But they didn't know that. They had no concept of that. They were looking for a single seed.
Right.
And that single seed obviously was in the woman's body, as indeed it is from birth. Mm-hmm. The seed is in the woman's body. And the first thing you learn about a seed is that it needs water, otherwise it doesn't grow. And the man now was conceptualized as the waterer, and the woman was the source of the seed. As the source of the seed, she was still, you know, the parent. She was still the generant. She was still the primary source of creation. And, in fact, there's a very nice figurine from Çatalhöyük in Turkey, which I'm sure you've heard of, which is a clay figurine where the seed has been pushed into through the back of the body, but it's basically sitting in the womb of this figurine. And then at some around about 3000 BC, when the plow came in, people started thinking, I say people, probably men started thinking, well, the seed is now in him, in his testicles, and he plants it in the body of the woman. That interface there between the idea that the seed is in the woman and the seed is in the testicles, this is an incredibly important interface in human history. And a lot of battles were fought on it, some of them evident in the Old Testament. In fact, you know, you could read the Old Testament as a battle between these two ideas. And then basically, you know, women's story became one of patriarchy, because she had no reproductive rights, because, hello, she didn't reproduce.
Yeah,
she just
incubated the seed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, she wasn't actually the seed. Well, and you know, and it's infuriating because I don't know whether you follow much of the politics over here in the United States, but we have these, you know, crazy fundamentalist, you know, Christian Republicans who are trying to push women back decades as they, you know, try to subject women to having to have unwarranted vaginal probes in order, you know, for them to get an abortion. And, you know, they're trying to cut back, you know, women's access to even birth control. So, you know, it's like this battle of the sexes, I mean, has been waging forever. And, you know, there doesn't seem any end in sight.
You know, Karen, I have a website which is called patriarchy-is-over.co.uk, and I'm sorry, but I'm living in the 21st century. If everybody else wants to live in the 19th century or the, you know, second century BC or the second millennium BC, you know, that's up to them. I feel very sad for them.
Are you there? Oh, I wonder if she hit the wrong button. Julia, if you can hear me, we can't hear you. I'm not sure what happened. If you can call back in, please, so we can finish the interview. I am going to take a moment and go ahead and do a commercial while hopefully Julia figures this out and calls back in.
The psychic state is the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet, or the chronic mind.
Hang on, we're getting back to Julia. Julia? Oops, sorry, wrong line. Julia?
Don't worry. Yes.
Hi. Sorry about that. I don't know what happened. You disappeared for a minute there.
Don't worry. Don't know either.
Okay. All right. So do you remember where you were in the middle of
yes.
the thought?
Yes, I do think. The thing is this. We had a good few thousand years there where people thought that the woman was not a generant. She did not generate. She was not a mother in the sense that we understand it. She was a tool, a womb, an oven you would put your bun into, the soil mm-hmm. a farmer would put his seeds into. But she was a tool. She was not actually creative. This is all in the literature, Karen. People have, you know, talked about this for thousands of years in these terms. The woman was inferior. And, you know, she carried no seed of life. That made her very distinct from a man.
Mm-hmm.
He had the creativity given to him by God, remember? I mean, it was
mm-hmm.
God-given. It was nature as people understood it. And so this nature came from God as they understood it. So to challenge it was blasphemous. You know, people
right.
could not go around challenging these ideas. And
and you see when patriarchy takes over, I mean, men actually take on the role of the female. I mean, and a perfect example of it is Athena is birthed from Zeus's head. You know, her mother Themis is totally taken out of the equation. I mean, she plays no part
yes.
in Athena's birth whatsoever.
That's right. And Athena originally, if going back in time, she was born from a lake. You know, Zeus wasn't in the picture. The earliest stories of Athena have her born in a completely different way. And that's very interesting because that period of time, the Greeks and the early Greeks in particular, you know, they had plays talking about this battle. And in fact, you know, Orestes, for example, was made to say, you know, he got off the charge of matricide because there was no such thing as a mother. I mean, these were propaganda plays, mm-hmm. played to the people to try and get them to stop their goddess-worshipping ways.
Well,
these battles
we can't
have been,
forget, you know, because I think sometimes we do. I mean, people for thousands of years, okay, thousands of years were going to the temples of Demeter and Persephone, you know, worshiping
yeah.
at the altar of a mother and daughter rather than
yeah.
male gods, you know, and that's thousands of years of, you know,
yeah.
of history, not just a little blip on the screen.
Oh, it's you know, Karen, the most impressive place is a cave in France, the Chauvet Cave,
mm-hmm.
where we have the earliest example of a figure, a human figure. It's 32,000 years old, and it is a vulva and basically the top of the legs, the thighs up to the knees. It's 3 feet high, and it's drawn on a pendant from the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in a cave that got closed off 20,000 years ago with a rock fall. So it's pristine in rock, you know, in caves. And this vulva is 3 miles down into the ground. And this was the first example we have to date of the veneration of the female body. And archaeologists said to me, oh, you know, there are figures of men. In my book, I examine every single figure of man there is from 25,000 years of history. It's you know, almost irrelevant, because what you do have is dozens of figurines of women. There is not one figurine of a man, you know. There is one that he's called the puppet of Brno, and it's actually a puppet, you know, bits of yeah, sorry, Karen.
Well, you know, the cave that you're talking about, I would imagine probably the documentary is available over in Europe too. But we have a documentary here that's available that shows that cave. It's called The Cave of Forgotten
yeah.
Dreams. And
oh, definitely.
You actually toward the very end, you actually get to see that vulva that you know, that you're referring to. And, you know, to piggyback on what you're saying about the absurdity that you know, that some archaeologists, you know, or scholars want to say that, you know, they weren't worshiping the female. I mean, I was talking to a young female scholar recently, and we were talking about the twins in Malta. You know, where you see some of these images were so clearly women, you know, wearing skirts.
Yes.
With small ankles, and archaeologists want to say, oh, well, we don't know those were women. You know, I mean, it's the extent they will go to keep male as dominant and just sort of squeeze female out of the picture. I mean, you know, they do backflips and somersaults. I mean,
they
borders
certainly
on
do.
Absurdity.
It is absurd. I mean, for example, that cave we're talking about, the Chauvet Cave, it's excavated by a guy called Jean Clot. In his book on the subject, he says, he says that this, obviously, this is the sanctum of this entire cave system. It's 3 miles down, you know. It is at the end of the passage. And he suggested that it might be closed to women and children and only available to initiates, who he assumed to be male. And, I mean, I'm sorry, but, you know, I mean, and people just accept this kind of nonsense. What makes him think that the initiates were male and the women and children weren't allowed and they were kept outside? That's just ridiculous.
Well, it is ridiculous. And, I mean, we see this, you know, this kind of thing, you know, happening over and over again, you know, the extent that they'll go to just, you know, keep the patriarchy alive and well and, I mean, not let any ideas in. And I mean, in that cave, for instance, okay, let's just take that as one example. We might not have written records from the Paleolithic, but these people, you know, they were talking to us in their symbols, in their artifacts.
Yes,
and,
definitely.
You know, in brilliant minds like Maria Gimbutas, who had, you know, had so many archaeological sites that she uncovered, You know, she was well versed in so many different, you know, linguistics and art, and I mean, you know, she wasn't just pulling these ideas, you know, out of the air. You know, she was able to, I mean, these artifacts spoke to her. She was able to, you know, give context to these images, and you know, rather than make these absurd suggestions, you know, from male archaeologists like we're talking about, and yet her and her work, you know, sort of gets drummed out of the academy, so to speak, and called trash. It's just another symbol of the sexism in academia.
Karen, you're absolutely right, and it is absolutely horrifying to me. I mean, I have been researching reproduction theory for 20-odd years, and I've, you know, lectured on, and I've met a lot of archaeologists, and I say to them about a particular figurine, for example, where did these people think babies come from? And I'm always met with a blank stare. They have no idea what I'm talking about because they think, like so many people do, that, quote, you know, people have always known the facts of life. Nothing could be further from the truth. People only knew the facts of life at the turn of the 20th century. Before then, it was, wrong ideas. But there is no doubt in my mind that people in the Paleolithic and followed by the Neolithic worshipped goddesses, because they are ubiquitous. And there is no kind of parallel in the Paleolithic. I mean, if you find a male, well, congratulations, because, you know, they are so few.
Yeah.
And when you get to the Neolithic, you know, the men are water gods, they're rain gods, they're thunder gods. I mean, a thunder is like, you know, a clap of a noise in the sky before the rain comes down. It is watering the seed in the female body, but she is the source of the seed.
Right.
She is the generant. that makes her the creator. And
right.
if you think about the world from a point of view of reproduction theory, which I do, then it is clearly, they are clearly goddesses. And, you know, I met a particular archaeologist at the British Museum one day, and I said to him, these people, it was 4,000 BC, Baluchistan, it's part of Pakistan. I said to him, these goddess figurines here, these figurines, where did these people think babies come from? He'd never even thought about the subject at all. And he said to me, oh, he said, oh, you're one of those goddess people, aren't you? And stood up, went to walk away. And I pulled him back, and he said, I'll tell you something. The women in that area today, they have the exact same hairstyle. And he turned around and walked away. And I'm thinking to myself, is he serious? Does he think that a hairstyle tells you what's inside somebody's head? It's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
You know? And this
well,
is the attitude
you know,
I come across.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, but, you know, I come across this attitude over and over again. And the reluctance to accept female spirituality, mind. And it's because with the patriarchal era, where you had the idea that the woman was not a generant, you also had the idea that the male was superior. It wasn't equal and different or anything like that. It was superior because he had that spark of life. You know the Sistine Chapel where God it has his finger extended to Adam?
Mm-hmm.
Their fingers
yeah.
touch, and there's a kind of spark where that happens. That is the spark of life
mm-hmm.
that the male God gave to Adam, not to Eve, you know.
Yeah.
And that is what we're talking about, that spark of life.
Well,
the woman obviously gave, you know, the body of the child, if you like, but not life itself. This is a very important distinction. And women have been excluded from the church, you know, for these reasons, because she's not in the image of you know, Jesus and so on. It's completely ridiculous.
And people will say, you know, well, why do you care about this? Well, we care about it because we're still suffering the ramifications of this sexism and this patriarchy today. I mean, as evidenced by what I just said a few minutes ago, you know, men trying to still control women's reproduction. You know, women still can't be ordained. Women are still making 75 cents, you know, on the dollar to a man. There's still 20% of women in leadership in academia, corporate America, you know, religious institution leadership. I mean, women are not, I mean, we may be half or more than half of the world, but we are not represented in the world as if, you know, it by our numbers.
You know what it is, Karen? Men are terrified that any concept of a woman that's outside the patriarchal norm means that they aren't going to have control, or at
mm-hmm.
least they think, you know, women are going to control them. They're going to nag them to death or some such. The thing about it is this. When you had the patriarchal notion, you had the source of the seed inside the man's body in his testicles. But you had the means of his production in another person, the woman,
mm-hmm.
on the other
mm-hmm.
side of the room, physically distinct. He felt he had to control that woman because either she was going to have the baby that was 100% his or 100% some other guy's. Now, go back to the period of time when the woman was thought to be the entire source of human life. And, yes, the man might help by watering, fair, fine. And, in fact, the more water you had from the more guys, the merrier type of thing. That was the problem with the Canaanites, you know, that kind of the monotheistic, you know, religions weren't too happy about. But the point is this. The seed is inside her body, but she also has the womb to bring that seed to fruition. So
mm-hmm.
she doesn't need to control anybody in terms of reproduction. There is no issue about her having to control the man. It's
right.
a completely different situation.
Right.
And, in fact, today, I mean, the Trobriand Islands, where I've been, there they don't think men have anything to do with reproduction. His job is to keep the baby passage open and lubricated because they believe that the seed that the woman gives birth to a regrown spirit. The spirit lives on this nearby island of Tuma, floats in. The woman's in the sea bathing. The spirit enters her body, and the blood of her body and the feeding of her body brings this baby to fruition. It's got nothing whatsoever to do with the man. His job
now you,
is...
Go back a minute, Julia. You said that's the Trobriand Islands. Trobriand Island. Where is that? Hello? Oh, not again. Julia? Oh. Okay, listeners, I am sorry. I don't know what's happening with Julia's phone here. I'm going to go ahead and do the commercial as I was going to do before till she calls back in. I apologize. I don't know what's happening tonight.
The psychic state is the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet. It's called the chthonic mind, the mind of the earth. Our ancestors.
Karen? Julia,
hello,
are you
Karen.
Having trouble with your phone?
I really don't know, Karen. I don't know why I'm having trouble with this today, but
okay.
We'll keep trying, if you don't
okay.
mind.
Okay.
The Trobriand Islands, I've been there, and on my website, you know, I've got quite a bit about them because they're very interesting. Men are not thought to be involved in reproduction at all. And
so where are those islands? Where are the islands?
They are basically, to get there, you get a plane to Papua New Guinea, and you get on a little tiny plane, and you head east. It's in the Solomon. They're in the Solomon Seas. It's a group of islands.
Okay.
South Pacific. And also Australia, the Aboriginal people there, they didn't think men have anything to any part to play in reproduction. And all these people live perfectly happily, you know, side by side. And there is no, you know, female control of men or anything like that. Everybody gets on fine. It's just, you know, men in our culture have just got this fear that if they don't have complete control over women, you know, all hell's going to break loose or something. It's ridiculous.
Well, yeah. I mean, and I wonder, you know, I really don't understand, quite frankly, what that primal fear is, you know. Maybe just logically, you know, they feel if women were their equals, then maybe it raises the bar and they have to perform to a higher level. I mean, let's face it, if many women didn't have to get married for economic reasons, maybe they wouldn't, you know, and, you know, maybe these guys would be left without somebody to perpetuate their lineage, or maybe they would, you know, have to be better men. I don't know. I mean, that sounds crazy maybe, but I just wonder how things would be different if women weren't, you know, economically forced into marriages, as is the case so often, because, you know, they don't make as much as men generally.
Yeah, that's that. I think, you know, that here's the old classic thing, isn't it? You're looking at two young people in front of you. You're doing careers advice, and the girl comes along. She's got straight A's, and you know, she doesn't have the ambition that this guy, who hasn't worked at all at school, who's got, you know, C's, he thinks he's going to be an astronaut. You know, girls have worked hard. There are more of them in university in the UK. I don't know about the USA. You know, there are more going into becoming doctors and so forth. And, you know, all that nice, cozy idea that men had, that they would be successful, make loads of money, get great jobs, all of that, that's looking very shaky these days because women are walking into those jobs.
Right. Well, it is changing here, too. Actually, Hannah Rosen has a book out called The End of Men, and what she means is the end of male dominance, because more females now are actually graduating from university. It's slowly more women are starting to make more money or as much money as men. With the economy as it's been, you know, so, you know, the austerity that everyone's been suffering from, a lot of the high-paying male jobs have been lost, and women are becoming the breadwinners of the family. So, you know, things are shifting. You know, the ground underneath men is not so solid as it used to be.
Not at all. And I think men, you know, need to stop whinging, to be honest with you, because I've done quite a lot of work with men, and there's a lot of whinging going on. You say, well, you know, we've got upper body strength, you know. I'm thinking, go to Africa and watch the women hauling stuff around, please. You know,
yeah.
Oh, men, you know, men are needed to work in the farms. Please go to Africa and spend a couple of years there watching the women, you know, entirely run the economy. You know.
Well, and it's not even, you know, most of the, you know, most of the world has changed too, and so much of our economy isn't even based on needing, you know, muscles. You know, brain power now.
But there is so much to do, Karen. Look at the state of the world. Look at the environment. Look how we're destroying the environment. Men need to be heroic. We want Greenpeace heroes. We want them out there doing stuff that is good for the planet and good for the children. You
right.
know, I mean, I don't know why they're whinging about, you know, losing a job. Go and do something heroic. You want to be a hero? Go and be heroic. Don't pick up
no,
a gun
but
and shoot somebody.
I think so many of them. I mean, I know this sounds like we're in male bashing, and I don't intend it that way, because there are a lot of good men out there who are actually helping
yeah.
us perpetuate these ideas. But you know, but you're right. I mean, these men should really kind of get with the program and realize that they are not the future, the way things are headed. You know, they need to evolve as well, and it's not going to continue to be the way it used to be.
You know, Karen, I bang on about reproduction theory because I think it is terribly important that people, especially men, realize that their superiority, their lovely reign of 5,000 years controlling, beating, you know, being superior, and they did think they were superior over women, that, you know, that reign has come to an end. It's like reproduction theory, if you like, was the mortar, the intellectual mortar that hung the towers of patriarchy together. It held them
mm-hmm.
tight.
Mm-hmm.
Now that idea has gone. And now the towers of patriarchy are kind of tumbling down, in some places
right.
quicker than others. But those towers will come down. There is no going back to the patriarchal idyll, as some people feel it to be,
right.
Which, of course, it wasn't.
Speaking of heroes, you mentioned in the materials you sent me that a hero of yours was Carl Ernst von Baer. Did you want to talk about him a little bit?
Yes, my lovely Carl Ernst von Baer, he actually had a nervous breakdown when he discovered the mammalian ovum, because, of course, there was a lot of hostility to that as well. That was in 1827. He discovered the mammalian ovum in a dog, and it didn't change the world or anything like that. But what it did mean is that embryology, which was just more or less starting around that time, could work with you know, egg and sperm, and do all kinds of experimentation, which they did. I mean, they worked on, you know, pretty much pond life, sea urchins, frogs, newts, fish, hydrosia, birds, rabbits, vertebrates, you know, and so on and so forth, all the way up until the 20th century, turn of the 20th century, when the work of Gregor Mendel was rediscovered on peas. They say it was rediscovered as if it had been hiding in a drawer somewhere. It hadn't. The guy had published 22 articles, but nobody had taken any notice of his work with peas, which showed that inheritance was both male and female in these peas. But all of that work was only made possible because of Carl. And when he looked through his microscope and saw the mammalian ovum, it was from a dog, in his microscope, he wrote in his autobiography, "I recoiled as if struck by lightning," as well he might, because he knew that vision of the mammalian ovum was going to completely overturn embryology and indeed people's ideas about where babies come from. I mean, there's this idea that, you know, scientists, these venerable guys throughout time, from Aristotle onwards, knew the facts of life. They did not. Charles Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus, he had no idea. And, you know, he talked about, well, even Charles Darwin had no idea. He talked about, you know, gemmules and pangenesis and so on and so forth.
Well, and you have a I like the sentence here you have in the material she sent. You said men thought women had no reproductive rights because they believed they did not in fact reproduce. You know, it's incredible really when you look back on it now how long they could have stayed in power by believing such bunk. And at the same time I say that, I have to share with you, because I don't think you could possibly know this, we have Republicans in our U.S. Congress who are supposed to be gynecologists who are in the thick of this fight going on right now with trying to, you know, keep women, you know, from controlling their own reproductive destiny, and they actually say that a woman, if she is genuinely raped, in other words, she didn't really want it, okay, if she was genuinely raped, the body produces some sort of defense mechanism to prevent her from becoming pregnant. But if she gets pregnant, then she really wanted it. It wasn't really legitimate rape. Now, these are gynecologists who are in our government making laws for our people. I mean, I can barely believe my own words, the insanity of it.
It's completely and utterly mad. It's mad. You know, Karen, I can't believe you're telling me this because, you know, this guy needs to, you know, get out of his position of power and go back to the funny farm, because this is ridiculous.
Well, I mean, you know, the Republicans over here, I mean, a lot of people are calling them sort of the, you know, the circus train, you know, but it goes to show you that in this day and age, the ignorance and the lack of scientific fact is still having impact in our laws and in people's lives. It's truly incredible.
It is, and you know, the thing, Karen, I mean, you know, we're talking about the history of embryology and the fact that it was known at the turn of the 20th century that women were in fact mothers. That slid in very, very quietly. There was a cover-up, you know, so that the guys who are the heroes of that, their names aren't known. Karl Ernst von Baer is not a household name, and he should be, as should, you know, other people involved in this incredible liberation of women from incubator status. You know, Oscar Hertwig, Hermann Foll, Rudolf Albert von Kolliker, all these people, you know, should be taught in school so people understand the ignorance that prevailed up until the turn of the 20th century. What we did instead was, you know, they jumped from cytology, discovery of cells and all of that, into genetics and missed out that little bit about the history of embryology. That battle's just been, I don't know, stashed under the carpet, in a cupboard, in a dusty cupboard somewhere.
Think, Julia, the reason for that is because embryology runs way, you know, it runs parallel to sexuality. And sexuality is just taboo when, you know, from a religious perspective. So I think that maybe that's why it was easy, you know, all of this, you know, this shame attached to sexuality. And maybe that's what made it such maybe an underground subject.
Definitely. I think you're absolutely right about that, Karen. It wasn't the subject of you know, parlor talk, you know, at the turn of the 20th century. And it just kind of got skipped over. It's not the kind of thing you want to discuss in mixed company in an open, you know, discussion in a church hall or something. It was, you know, the reasons you absolutely say. But let me say something. When I talk to archaeologists archaeologists, they have this word that they apply to all the goddess figurines. It's fertility. Fertility figurines. as if it's something to do with old women having babies or plants growing nice and strong, something like that. I don't believe that people in the ancient past had any, you know, that wasn't what it was about. It was about a goddess in the same sense of the oral creatrix, creating everything, the stars, the earth, the moon, thought, memory, singing, everything, you know, everything, the creatrix. And what they've done is they've mixed up sex, reproduction, and fertility. They think they're all kind of the same thing, and they're not at all. They've mixed up sex and reproduction. There are a lot of people in the world who do not equate the act of intercourse, sex, with reproduction. They need to separate out these two things and not see these figurines as somehow, well, they do with the Paleolithic, some kind of ancient pornography, which is the most ridiculous concept I've ever heard. It's not about sex. That's not why these women are going around with, you know, no clothes on, why their breasts are bare or their vulvas prominent. It's not about sex. It's about reproduction.
Right.
And this is what they need to get to grips with. Once
Well, you look at the Venus of Willendorf, for instance. There was a six-part documentary that came out on PBS called How Art Changed the World. And one of the artifacts that they talked about was the Venus of Willendorf. Now, I almost you know, threw things at the TV screen, because what the narrator was saying was the Venus of Willendorf had these abundant proportions, not because it's the whole idea of, you know, the goddess provided all we needed to sustain ourselves. It was, no, instead he saw this, you know, this abundant figure, because he said people needed figures that didn't look like them. You know, they needed to somehow, you know, that, like with the Greek statues who were, you know, had such perfection. You know, they in other words, they couldn't look mortal. They couldn't look like everyday people. That was his interpretation of why, you know, the Venus figurines, you know, have the ample buttocks and the ample breasts, rather than this whole idea that goddess is everything. You know, she is the abundance of the world. She is the creatrix of all. I mean, that whole
idea
just went right over his head. And, he comes up with this other, in my opinion, absurd interpretation taken as fact. And it just amazes me that when a man says something, people listen, and when a woman says something, somehow it's discredited as trash.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like
Marie
Gimbutas, for instance, you know?
Yes, that's right. It is. It's shocking. It's absolutely shocking. Well, listen, I've spoken to enough archaeologists to know, you know, that they have never given a single thought to reproduction. They've given plenty of thought to sex, you know, pornography, all of that. And they've pushed all these ancient figurines into this idea of fertility. But what was this fertility? If we look at the Paleolithic, this fertility was fertility for everything. You know, every single thing in the universe, including your thoughts and mine. Fertility in the Neolithic was about, you know, the fertility that was being watered by the male. It was a different kind of fertility. Once you get to the idea of the male seed in the female soil, her fertility now is a different thing. It's like soil, you know, whether it's going to, you know, whether it's dry and too dry to kind of. And then we get into our era, and when we talk about fertility, we're thinking about 50% of that child. You know, it's a different kind of fertility. These are four different fertilities, and I'm being very kind of general in this scope, but I can see at least four distinct, very, very different eras of reproduction theory, and there are many more, because this is a complex subject that should fill a library, not just my book, and I'm the only one who writes about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's really a good point. I mean, I honestly haven't heard that talked about much, even amongst women's studies, people.
Right.
I mean, we talk about, we get angry because they see these female figurines as fertility images, or they call them ancient Barbie dolls, when in fact that's crazy because, we know that, it was always the female images that were found in the greatest abundance. They were usually found in places that were sacred, and they were made by the best artists using the best materials of the time.
Definitely.
That wouldn't happen if it was just some little child's trinket.
Not at all. And I mean, for example, there's a site in Malta. It's called MAL_TA, as distinct from the island of Malta in the Mediterranean. It's in the central Siberian plateau of Russia. They found there 30 female figurines. And at Gagarino, on the bank of the River Don in Russia, archaeologists have uncovered another 11. These weren't just like the one-off little Barbie dolls. They are ubiquitous, and they're powerful. You know what they look like. They're full of power.
Those ones that you're talking about in Russia, I hadn't heard about those. Are those Venus figurines, or are they older?
Yes.
More current?
No, they're old. I mean, I don't think they're. I think they're in the sort of 20,000 BC type of time.
Yeah, that range.
They're actually slim. They're not. Voluminous women. They're slim women. This idea that all these women were big. They weren't. They were dancing. They were slim. They were all kinds of women. It wasn't just, big women.
Right, right.
So, we're talking about womanhood, women
right.
dancing, young women, the youth, the fertile woman, the crone, all of them were
right.
reproduced. I've got quite a few pictures in my book, you can see they're just, I know Karen, but, they are images of power. These have got nothing to do with Barbie. And, very annoyingly, talking about that Chauvet cave, the guy who directed that film you were talking about, that beautiful film which is in 3D, which I urge anybody to see, he said that Venus, I say it's a vulva, it's 3 foot high, it's incredibly powerful, is in the same tradition as Baywatch. I mean, for God's sake, Baywatch. it just beggars belief, Karen. And they don't see that they are looking utterly ridiculous. Nature magazine talking about a fantastic figurine found in Germany have filed it in their website under prehistoric pinup.
Gee.
This kind of thing is going on. Nature magazine, it's a very academic journal. Nature. We're not talking about, TV quick or something. It's nature. And these are what academics who take themselves terribly seriously are doing with these figurines. They're belittling them. Baywatch. Pin-up.
Right, right.
Barbie.
So what's the alternative? If they want to, it's horrendous. It's despicable. It lacks integrity. They should be ashamed of themselves. But the reality is, if they started looking at these things with fresh eyes and gave them the just credence that they deserve, they would have to rewrite history, and they're not willing to do that.
Oh, they'll have to do it. I'm sure they will. Because reproduction theory isn't going to go away. Every time I see an archaeologist, I say, where do these people think babies come from? The reason they don't understand it as a question is because they think people have always known the facts of life. And, once you kind of, get to grips with the notion that, in fact, this is a very, recent thing that we had a mother and a father, extraordinarily though that sounds, then they will have to say, kind of backtrack in time and say, well, these people didn't think that the male was planting his seed in the woman because there were no seeds. They weren't thinking about seeds until 10,000 BC, round about Syria, Turkey, that area.
Right.
So You know, they weren't thinking about seed. So what were they thinking? They will have to ask that question. And you know, once you ask that question, then you say, well, obviously the seed is in the woman, because people were doing hunter, you know, they were doing hunter gatherings, and they were gathering seed that had been dropped. It was grain, remember. They thought of it as grain. It was food to them. And then they dropped it, the rains came, it grew into a plant, and they suddenly realized it wasn't grain, it was seed.
Mm-hmm.
So when you find a figurine in a, what the archaeologists call a grain bin, I call it a seed store, because it's
right.
Seed. It's not. It was grain. Then they discovered it was seed. That was, of course, you know, the biggest revolution of all time in terms of, you know, human history, discovering seed and farming.
Well, and that makes me think about Chateau Hayuk in Turkey. That image, probably the early Kabeli with the two lions on either side. She's found in a grain bin or a seed bin.
That's right.
In Chateau Hayuk. And Ian Hodder, that's another one of those archaeologists who has been so stubborn. I mean, they've managed to get him to come round a bit. But, you know, he still poo-poos Maria Gimbutas and James Mellert's, you know, interpretations of Chateau Hayuk as well, you know. It's incredible fear in these men, you know. I say that, you know, partially compassionate and partially angry, because, you know, I guess I'm an idealist, and I feel like if you're a scholar, you know, you should be dedicated to learning and knowledge. And if that means you have to rethink something, if that means you have to rewrite history, if that means that suddenly men's roles in the world shift, well, then so be it. Because otherwise,
that's right.
you're just a prostitute to a particular agenda. You know,
I feel sorry for them, because they are wrong, and they will be shown to be wrong. History will show them to be wrong. I have no doubt about that, because Chateau Hayuk, there's also a very interesting, those felines that she's holding are more likely leopards, because the leopard was incredibly important to this particular site in Turkey, which, you know, for the listener, is about 6,500 BC to about 7,200 BC. That's the period we're talking about in Anatolia, central Anatolia. Now, the thing about the leopards is that people did not bring leopards into the... It's a very long story about this, but the most important thing that's been found in Chateau Hayuk in recent times is a skull that has been plastered red and white and red and white, you know, several times. And this skull is of a woman, and she has around her a leopard claw, and it was drilled to make a hole and was used as a pendant. And this pendant was found in the grave around the neck of this woman, who held in her arms the female skull I'm talking about to you that's been plastered red and white, you know, three times. This is the only piece of leopard in this site, which is very, very large, as you know. It's being worn by a woman, not a man, a woman, and the woman holds another woman in her arms. You know, this talks about ancestry. This talks about status. And I'm afraid that Ian is going to have, you know, the more he digs up that site, the more of a hard time he's going to have. And in that site, as I said earlier, there is a figurine with a seed stuck inside it, in the womb area. They call it in the back, but it's in the womb area. And, you know, I'm afraid they will all be shown to be wrong. I really do believe that, Karen, because they haven't even thought about reproduction theory. And they haven't thought... how venerable these women were, because they were the creators, and they need to get to grips with that.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, you know, I mean, we think about, you know, women, we think they created agriculture. We think they were the first to, you know, invent animal husbandry, if invent is the right word. You know, goddess was mistress of the animals herself. And, I mean, they just don't want to give ancient women their due. And, you know, I like to say, you know, so-called great minds were once certain the world was flat and that the sun revolved around the earth, and they were proven wrong. And I think in due time, you know, perhaps the way we think and the stuff that we see will be in the majority, you know, rather than sidelined, you know, as something they call trash.
I think it's absolutely shocking the way they approach the whole prehistoric female evidence. It's unprofessional. It's sexist. It is an academic, and you know, it's in the same kind of tradition of a sort of semi-science, you know, that we've had, you know, seen throughout time. I mean, talking about that Chatalhoyuk figurine that you just mentioned there with the two felines, that whole feline tradition spread across a huge area of, you know, of the Mediterranean, right over to Israel. We've got two felines in a seal dated 4000 BC from the Indus Valley civilization. We've got in a Minoan Crete shows two lions looking up at the mother of the mountains, and a gold pendant from Canaan shows the queen of heaven standing on a lion. The Iranian goddess Anahita is shown holding the front legs as two standing felines. The Hittite goddess Hebab and the Hurrian goddess Shushoka stand on lions, and the Greek Cybele is shown in a chariot being pulled by lions. Hello, this is a theme of felines.
Absolutely.
Crossing a vast geographical area and a huge period of time. And, you know, I don't know why they can't see it. It's completely beyond me.
Well, I think it's willful ignorance. Well, Julia, it has been a pleasure to speak to you tonight. Thank you so much for calling in the middle of the night at the UK there. And for listeners who want to learn more about your work, let's give your website again. It's patriarchyisover.co.uk. But listeners, there's dashes in there, so let me be more specific. Go ahead, Julia.
It's www.patriarchy-is-over.co.uk, and my book is Father Seed, Mother Sorrow. I have made that book extremely cheap. It's a full, long book with lots of pages and charts and illustrations, and that is $4, Karen, because I want people to read this book.
Well, that's a must. I mean, how can anybody, I mean, that's a must that should be on people's shelves, and how can they turn it down for $4? Listeners, please buy it.
Well, it's online. It's an e-book. It's an e-book, so it won't go on the shelf, but I would love people to read it because this is a very important subject, and, you know, I've kept the book cheap because I want people to read this.
Well, you know, in that way also, too, let me just suggest this to listeners. When you run across, you know, someone who doesn't have an open mind about herstory, you can be armed with this information. And rather than just have to, you know, be quiet about and hear them drone on about what they think history is, then you can come back and say, but
yes.
Do you know
That's
about
totally
this?
True.
Absolutely.
Yes, I do use that her story because, you know, it was his story, but it was only his story from around 3000 BC or even 1000 BC, you know, and it was her story before then. The evidence is clear.
I know.
It's even in the writing. It's even in the writing, Karen. It's not just the iconography, it's in the writing.
Yeah, you just have to look at it with fresh eyes. Well,
yes,
Julia,
definitely.
Thank you. Thank you so much. My second guest is on the switchboard here, and it has been a pleasure to talk to you tonight. Thank you for your dedication to bring this information to the forefront. I applaud your effort and your integrity and your dedication. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Karen, so much. It's been lovely to talk to you.
Okay. Keep in touch, okay? Let me know what you're doing down the road.
Thank you, Karen. You too. Take care.
All right. Good night. Well, listeners, I hope you enjoyed that conversation, and I hope you will go and check out her ebook. And we are about ready to talk to our second guest. Next up, we have Anadia Judith. Let me tell you a little bit about her before we start our chat. She's a world-renowned teacher and best-selling author who's been called a prophet for our time. With a master's and doctorate in psychology and healing, she's been a lifelong student of history, mythology, comparative religion, yoga, sociology, and politics. She's best known for her groundbreaking works, bridging Eastern disciplines with Western psychology through her classic books, Wheels of Life and Eastern Body, Western Mind. She has created an award-winning DVD, The Illuminated Chakras, an empowering manual for manifestation, Creating on Purpose. We're here today to talk about her newest book on social evolution, The Global Heart Awakens, Humanity's Rite of Passage from the Love of Power to the Power of Love. Well, Anadia, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Karen. Delighted to be here.
Well,
sounds
I
like
think.
Good. I wish
I'm sorry.
It.
Go ahead.
Oh, this previous guest. I just heard the tail end. It sounded fascinating, and I wish I had heard the whole call.
Well, you'll be able to listen to the show in the archives. But I think both of the interviews, in a sense, will be complementary because you talk about how the union of divine masculine and divine feminine create the sacred marriage, and we've just been lamenting the fact that patriarchy, what patriarchy has done to women throughout the world, and hasn't, is sort of, denigrated the feminine, whether we're talking about academia, corporate America, religious institutions, the woman has not really gotten her equal due. And I think you're one of these voices that's saying that until, the divine masculine and feminine are on equal footing, then maybe things won't be so right with the world.
Well, until we have them on equal footing, we're not really playing with a full deck. As long
True.
As the feminine is repressed, we've repressed, a major archetype of creation, and it's no wonder that creation looks like it's being threatened right now. With that,
right.
It's not only what is done to women, which is deplorable in many places, but it is what is missing from the whole culture in the way that we all suffer from what is missing in the feminine contribution.
Well, true, because anything that's been labeled feminine has somehow been less than or unimportant or weak. And, and all of those attributes that have been missing front and center are why we're in the shape we're in. Whether we're talking about multinational corporations raping the earth or we're talking about the haves and the have-nots. There's so many symptoms of, not seeing the world through the divine masculine and divine feminine side by side.
Exactly. And, I argue that it's not that, the divine feminine all by itself is the answer, but that to have this divine partnership, we need as many goddess temples as we have Christian and churches and Jewish synagogues and mosques,
Right,
and Muslim
right.
mosques. If you look at the Western world, you can hardly name a single, public temple to the goddess. In the Western world, and look at the number of churches and all that we have. So until that gets equaled up, and that's not going to be anytime soon, but, it just shows how the divine is worshipped in masculine form alone.
And it brings to mind that even it just having the goddess temples are not the solution. Because look at India, for instance. You know, they've never forgotten the goddess, but the culture is so patriarchal. You know, the goddesses have become what some scholars call spousified or domesticated. You know, they aren't in their full power. And so even then, just, you know, having the goddess is not the solution, you know. You know, goddess has to be there in her full glory, in her full power, in her full splendor as an archetype, you know, for women and for men, you know, and all the attributes that we label feminine, you know, need to be valued again, I think, in order to heal all the woes, you know, I think we're suffering from on the planet.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I saw a part of a movie last night. I have to admit that I walked out, called Elysium. It was a futuristic movie, and I walked out because the future they projected was so entirely masculine, and it was brutish and ugly and cruel. And I just, you know, thought, that's not the future that I see. That's not the future that I want to project. But it was a future that was totally dominated by masculine values.
Well, and not only that, but I actually saw it Tuesday myself, come to think of it. And what I saw was it was very grim, and it was the continuation of this haves and have-nots. You know, this idea that, you know, the white-skinned people have everything and the brown and black-skinned people are left with the scraps at the bottom of the heap. You know, so I was seeing that 99 versus 1% battle still being waged, you know, and we, you know, still in the future haven't, you know, haven't really gotten it right. It was bleak. It was bleak. But you're here to perpetuate a more positive agenda than this stuff we've been talking about. That's the past. How do we do that, Anadia? You know, how do we take a situation that sometimes feels hopeless, that you know, it feels like the forces are overwhelming, to, you know, to keep the oppression, you know, and that boot on our neck. You know, how do we shift things?
Well, that's the question of the day now, isn't it? First of all, I would say that to shift from the hopelessness is that we have to step back and take the long view. We have to take a meta view of the story of humanity. And when we do, when we go into the past, it's like evolution, cultural evolution is a story that's been unfolding for a long time. And if we don't look at the whole story, we don't understand where it's going. It's like picking up a novel and opening it randomly to a book in the middle, to a page in the middle of the book, and then not understanding where it's going and why the characters are doing what they're doing. But if you read it from the beginning, it all makes sense. So if we go back to the beginning of the human story, and this is again where it ties into the divine feminine, we see that the divine feminine was the first thing that we worship, just like a child worships his or her mother. When they're first born, that's the main object for survival, even. And then when the goddess was so seriously plowed under by the uprising of what I call the dynamic masculine, which is not to make it bad or wrong, it's just what happened in history, we see what ensued from the loss of the goddess and how what we have built has been built on a ground that, like I say, is only playing with half the deck. So if you were in a poker game and you only had half a deck to play with and they were, you know, not all of the cards and you kept losing your hand, you'd say, wow, I just can't play and this looks hopeless. But if somebody points out to you that there's a whole nother treasure that is present that you could be accessing that could bring a win to the game, and of course it's not just that simple, but it gives you a sense of hope when you see the big picture.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, as we look at, you know, all of the little individual battles that are going on across the country, you know, as women try to keep their access to contraception, keep their access to their, you know, reproductive rights, you know, fight for equal pay, it really is just a blip on the screen when you think, you know, it wasn't that many decades ago when women couldn't even vote. And, you know, it wasn't that many decades ago that, you know, somebody could have their house firebombed for even mentioning the word goddess. It feels like things aren't moving fast enough. But I understand what you're saying. We have to really sort of take the long view.
Yes, and if we take the long view of evolution in general, we see that it's a story that actually makes a lot of sense, and it unfolds in the way it should, and we're just at a particular point in the story, which I say is moving from our adolescence as a culture, or as a species, if you will, to our adulthood. And that adulthood, you know, children, when they go through, like, you know, middle childhood, the boys and girls don't play together very much. Mostly boys play with boys and girls play with girls. And then when they get to be adolescents, they start looking at each other again. And when they get to be adults, they make a partnership. And so I see in the culture that for quite a long time, as men went off to war and women stayed home with the kids, and men went to work and women stayed home with the kids, and that, you know, men and women have lived very separate, they've lived in separate realms of society. And now, you know, it's, you know, men are staying home with kids more often, women are going out into the workplace, you have both men and women in lots of, you know, jobs and professions. We're starting to come back together in a kind of partnership that we've never been in before.
Well, that's an interesting take on it. You know, and in a way, that's sort of making lemonade of the lemons of our horrible economy that has sort of forced this, you know, these different roles on so many people, because, you know, lots of people aren't doing this by choice. You know, they're doing it because it's necessity, you know, quite frankly. But we were just saying with it in the previous guest, you know, I mean, we have more women that are graduating from college than ever before. You know, they're starting to make more money. You know, they're getting married much later. You know, many of them, you know, aren't even feeling forced to be mothers if, you know, they don't have that cultural pressure anymore. So, you know, maybe in the next few decades we could see life very different than what we feel is the norm today.
Yes, I think it's changing much more than people realize. 60% of college graduates are women. I mean, that's remarkable that we are getting more educated. And I think women are also leading the spiritual revolution. You know, I spend my life traveling the world teaching at, you know, metaphysical bookstores, yoga centers, retreat centers, things like that. It's a wonderful life. But I noticed that the population that goes there is about 70-80% women. So women are the ones getting on the mats. Women are the ones studying meditation, not exclusively, of course, but you know, women are going to be leading the spiritual revolution.
Right. Well, you know, it reminds me of I was listening to, I think it was an economist or somebody. He was talking about how, you know, with our finite resources, you know, we can't be focused on this, you know, this growth. You know, we're too big into, we have to grow more, we have to grow more, we have to be more into development. And I hear you saying that. You know, women are more into developing themselves. You know, maybe they are evolving maybe at a quicker, higher rate than a lot of men out there who are desperately trying to hold on to the past because it's familiar to them. You know, they want to keep control and, you know, keep things as it's always been, this white male privilege, and, you know, but it's slipping through their fingers. Maybe that's why they're getting so crazy right now.
Well, yes, but let's give the men a little bit more credit, because I think the reason they hold on to control is it's been made out to that was their job. You know, they were told in a certain way, go fight and protect us or hold society together with your law and order. And, you know, they were raised in part of the paradigm of the patriarchal paradigm is that is the job of a man, to be rigid, to hold. And so they're kind of just doing their job. And control they have on society, you know, people want to just bust that up. But a new organizing principle has to mature to the point where it can survive, and then we outgrow that old one.
Right.
I mean,
right.
If you look
at
Egypt.
That transition takes time. It's not something we can just do overnight.
No, no. And we actually have to work together on that transition.
And you know, and I think it can be messy, too. I mean, I'm thinking about what's going on in Egypt right now. You know, we talk about, you know, democracy and all of this stuff, but, you know, it's just like politics. They use that analogy. It's, you know, it's like making sausage. It's ugly. You know, I think we get these ideals in our head that, you know, democracy is a beautiful thing. And, yeah, maybe it is when it works, but, you know, sometimes you get bloodied fighting for it. You know, it just isn't something that maybe manifests, you know, without some challenges and without real pain and suffering.
Yeah, and there's certainly going on in the Middle East and all the overthrow of the old dictators. It's been messy and violent, and many people have died in the cause. And just like women died in the cause trying to fight for the right to vote.
Right, right, absolutely.
That was, as you pointed out.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, you know, Anadia, because I know sometimes we forget, you know, we do forget that maybe men are just trying to do what they were taught they're supposed to do, you know. So, yeah, we have to give them, maybe cut them a little bit of slack. But in the paperwork your publicist sent, there was an interesting statement that I wanted you to delve into a little bit and explain to me. Evolution is God's way of making more gods. What does that mean? That's really piqued my curiosity.
Yeah, so that's a basic theme of the book, because the book is about evolution and how we evolve. And so if you study evolution from, you know, the single-celled organisms to humans with computers and cars and airplanes, you see that what is created is ever more complex creatures with more intelligence, more capacity, more power, and the ability to control or manage larger amounts of, you know, stuff, people, you know, larger amounts of life.
Okay.
You know, so a mouse can't handle as much life as I can, right?
Right.
I mean, I have more capacity than a mouse. Anybody would agree with that. So we are evolving. So we are actually becoming, at this point on the planet, we have the power as a species on a godlike scale. We have the power to blow ourselves up with nuclear weapons and end life on the planet. That is like the destructive power of a god. We have the power to change the gene pool. We have the power to change the climate, and that's what we're doing. We have the power to transplant, you know, limbs and hearts. We have the power for epic creation or potential annihilation. So we have the powers of creation and destruction at our hands as a species, because they're now on a planetary scale. But what is obviously missing is we don't have the maturity, the spiritual maturity, to match our power. And that comes, I argue in the book, through an initiation. That's how adolescents get to adulthood. They have some kind of initiatory challenge or ordeal. And I think that the situations, the environmental situation in particular on this planet, is going to be the challenge that humanity will face, that is an evolutionary driver to force us to wake up latent powers and abilities and really the maturity of divine consciousness. So it's part of our education in how we become as gods, as it were. So evolution is always moving toward the divine.
Well, that makes sense. And you know, what I'm thinking about, too, is, you know, if we just sort of use our own lives as a model, you know, just sort of reduce it down to a more personal level. You know, it's through our challenges that we grow and we evolve. And I think you're saying the same thing, you know, for us as a species, so to speak. You know, it's the challenges that we go through as individuals that, you know, help us become a better version of ourselves. And that's what's happening to humanity as well. You know, these challenges are either going to make us or break us, so to speak.
Right.
You know?
It's like expression, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So
right.
The challenge, you know, the message is transform or die. But these challenges literally awaken something that was not being activated before. And what I think it's awakening when we talk about humanity as a whole is that everyone that looks, you know, realistically at what is happening in the world as an individual feels small and helpless as an individual. Like, I'm just one person. What can I do about global warming and deforestation and ocean acidity and poverty and, you know, on and on and on? And the fact is, one person is overwhelmed by it and can't handle it. And so it is forcing people to band together. It is actually, these are problems that can only be solved by global cooperation. And, for instance, global warming can only be solved by global cooperation. And in a sense, you know, even if we bring this back again to the divine feminine, often in the archetypal sense, water is, as an element, is more connected with the feminine, fire with the masculine. So global warming is too much fire and not enough water,
mm-hmm.
not enough cool the fires. And one thing that it will result from that is a huge imbalance in water, torrential rains and floods and droughts in other places, because the water element has been so rejected and what it represents.
Right, right. Well, and you said you said the word cooperation before. I mean, cooperation is more of a feminine value than it is a masculine value. And I'm wondering, is cooperation, let's see, I want to phrase this right, you know, is cooperation maybe a nuanced version of love, you know? Is that how love can manifest collectively or on a larger scale than, you know, one-on-one? Because obviously, you know, as a liberal, you know, I wonder, you know, how can we ever get conservatives to come around to our way of thinking? And I've been told that, you know, their fear can only be cured by love, but, you know, I can't change Rush Limbaugh, you know. So I'm wondering if if love is, you know, is the equivalent of cooperation and cooperation is the equivalent of love. I mean, is that what we're looking toward for the future? Is that our version of love, cooperation?
Well, it's part of it. I wouldn't say they are exactly equivalent, because I would say love is bigger than that. But when I was working with this, I was asking, you know, what is the next organizing principle for humanity? We've been organized by power. We've been organized by someone taking charge and telling everybody else what to do. And that's how society is structured, from the president and his cabinet to the Congress and, you know, on down to the people, the way a corporation is, you know, it's the way the Catholic Church is organized. So that's been our organizing principle. And so what I'm seeing is that love is an organizing principle. It's more than just a sentiment. It's more than just a romantic notion. It is actually a way that parts of a system are organized together. And cooperation is a facet of that. It's not the only thing, but it is an essential facet that we voluntarily cooperate. You know, it's like, I agree to cooperate with you because in doing so, it serves the whole better and it serves even our self-interest better.
Right.
And adults do that. Children have to do what their parents tell them because that's appropriate when a child doesn't know much about the world. But adults have their own will and they decide what to do with it. And true adults decide to cooperate and work collaboratively with other people. So I think it is both a mark of maturity and an aspect of the heart, an aspect of love. But I think there are other aspects too, generosity and compassion and forgiveness and peace and things like that are also aspects of love as an organizing principle.
So basically, then how do we make that shift to the organizing, you know, to go from the organizing principle of, you know, power over or control to love? I mean, how does that shift you know, actually manifest in a real, tangible kind of way? I mean, what can individual people do on a daily basis?
Yeah, well, that's just a wonderful question. And the fact is, we can see how it's happening because it's already happening. For one thing, Paul Hawken talks about how the largest movement on the planet today, the largest movement of humanity into any social thing that we can track, and in fact the largest movement in the history of the planet, is people moving voluntarily into volunteering their energy for non-governmental organizations designed to serve the environment, social justice, democracy, peace, the study of consciousness, healing, I mean all of those kind of things. It's not coming from the government. It's not coming from someone telling him you have to put so many hours of community service in. It is coming from people wanting to serve what they love and to save what they love. And it is coming from people that have enough power in their own lives. In other words, they're not in abject poverty, living in survival. They have enough, a little bit of a freed up energy that they can actually join something. And so, you know, what I would say to the average person is find what breaks your heart, and there's where your service lies. This is actually a quote from Andrew Harvey, and that where you feel called by your heart to serve, that's where you'll also find your joy. And find an organization that addresses sex trafficking or, you know, disappearing forests or, you know, topsoil turning to desert or whatever it is that really keeps you awake in the night. Find an organization that does that and join up and give some time or some money or some support. Talk to your friends about it. And we make this happen by having little pockets of it.
So in other words, it's like they used to say a long time ago when environmentalism was just, you know, sort of, you know, getting going, and they said, act local, think global. So do your own little part, and then if everybody does their own little part, the big picture sort of takes care of itself, in a sense.
It does. You get these little pocket experiments, and then somebody gets to demonstrate that something works. And, you know, like, I've been in the yoga world for many decades now, and I've seen yoga be from something that, you know, most people thought was a fermented dairy drink to, you know, a movement that is sweeping the world. And how does it happen? Well, you know, there's little pockets of people that practice, and then they go to a party and they meet somebody they haven't seen in 5 years, and somebody says, wow, you look great. What have you been doing? And they say, well, I've been, you know, doing yoga and eating organic or whatever they say. And somebody says, well, I want what she's having, you know. So when we do something in little pockets that looks good, then people naturally want to gravitate to it. And
right.
Then it gets bigger and larger.
You know, I didn't get a chance to read the article, but I saw a headline today about, is yoga the new religion? I wonder how you would respond to that.
Yeah, I see yoga centers popping up the way Christian churches did back in the, you know, 3rd and 4th century. And it is, in some sense, a kind of new religion. And it's a different one in that it doesn't require a mediating priest. It doesn't require a hierarchy. It is somebody getting on the mat and having their own personal experience with evolving their body and mind to better embrace the divine. So in a sense, I think it is. And if you see the devotees of this religion, they're pretty fierce about it.
Well,
you know?
So if someone hasn't ever, I know some of the, you know, some of the Christian ministers are freaked out, you know, telling their congregants, you know, they better not go do yoga because, you know, the devil may attack them. It's absurd, really, but for someone who hasn't done yoga, I mean, you know, if it, to them it just looks like all of these impossible physical postures that they don't think they could get their body into, what would you say to them to get them to try?
Well, I would say yoga is not the physical postures. the physical postures are simply a practice, and that yoga happens wherever you meet your edge, and that the person who's brand new to it is going to get a lot more out of it than the person that can get their head all the way down to the knee where there's not that much happening anymore. So I would say that if they find the right teacher, they will find a way to unlock themselves, but it's a non-competitive sport, you know. It's not about getting as bendy as the person on the mat next to you. It's about being in your own experience.
So would you say it goes beyond just a physical stretching and relaxation? I mean, there's more that happens than that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it opens your chakras, for one thing. It tones your body. It in yoga, there's something called nadis, which are pathways for energy to move. And yoga actually clears your nadis so that your energy moves through your body. And it really literally changes your awareness.
Okay. I'm someone who's actually been thinking of starting to take yoga, and I've been holding myself back because I've been sedentary way too long writing books. And the thought of getting on the mat with all of these, you know, thin young women is pretty intimidating.
I can relate. I can understand. Yeah, well, find a beginning level class, and the teacher that is, you know, the really good teachers are the ones that know how to teach beginners. So they know how to take that. That's, and I was even saying in my teacher training that, you know, it's like anybody can teach advanced people. You want to do fancy poses, big deal. The real teacher knows how to interface with a beginner to show them the wonders of yoga at their own pace.
Okay. Well, and I know you're really big into the chakras as well. Bridging philosophies of East and West. How do you teach the chakras different than, say, maybe your average teacher?
Well, I've worked with it for 40 years, so I say I have it pretty. You know, I've taught it bottom up and the top down and the spiral into the heart and the inside out. And, you know, I kind of taught it every which way. So I may have just thought about it more than most anybody on the planet. But
okay.
The teaching I do is very embodied. The chakras occur within the body, and we access them through feeling the body, moving the body, paying attention to the body. It's an embodied practice and an embodied awakening. And so we are spirit embodied. And the chakras are, I call it the rainbow bridge that connects heaven and earth through the center of each one of us. So the chakras really describe a path for evolution and a way through, essentially.
I see.
A way through.
Well, in a yoga class, will they work with the chakras, or that it depends on the teacher?
Well, it depends on the teacher. Some teachers, more and more teachers, are mentioning the chakras and learning how to do it. But, you know, and that's what my trainings are for, is to teach yoga teachers how to bring the chakras into their teaching, to have a real understanding of how do you gain access to these treasures within you that can unfold the mystery.
Right. And will and help us evolve as human beings.
Exactly.
Well, Anadeya, I know we sort of got a little sidetracked with the yoga and stuff, but is there anything more you wanted to share with listeners about the global heart and our shift into, you know, into more of a consciousness of love and power and control that maybe we haven't talked about?
Well, you know, when we bring it into the chakra system, then I say that we are moving from the third chakra, or the power center, as our main focus and drive to the heart chakra. So it's a moving, the heart chakra is chakra 4, right in the center. So it's a moving upward in consciousness to a higher state, but it's not one that denies the power. It's not where we give up our power to get to love, but where we stand in our power in order to reach for love. And in that, I love to quote, let me just grab the book here, Martin Luther King, who said it so beautifully. He said, What is needed is a realization that power without love is reckless and abusive, and love without power is sentimental and anemic. Power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice. And justice at its best is power correcting everything that stands against love.
Mm.
So we need the power to bring about the social change.
Right.
But the social change we're bringing is about shifting toward a more heart-based paradigm.
Right.
So I'm
right.
teaching another course right now called Love-Powered Evolutionaries. And this is, you know, the name I've come up with for people who are evolutionary agents like yourself, you know, whether they're working in media or writing books or teaching or working in government or working in finance, that have a more evolutionary perspective and that they see that that perspective is love, but they're powered by the love, which I call the power of love,
mm-hmm.
rather than their love for power.
Right, exactly. It's almost like your perfect social justice activist. You know, they're in it because they, you know, they care about the we and the us rather than the I and the me. You know, they want to see the world be a better place. You know, that's what's motivating them, not having power for themselves, you know, to wield it over anyone, so
yeah,
to speak.
Exactly.
Well,
so,
you know, it has been an enlightening conversation, Anna D. I want to thank you so much. Can you tell listeners where they can find your books and your classes and all of that good stuff in case they want to seek you out?
The website for the new book is called globalheartawakens.com, and that has information on the book and some free stuff you can download. My main website is sacredcenters.com. That's S-A-C-R-E-D, centers, plural, C-E-N-T-E-R-S.com, and that has all my workshops and events, speaking engagements. I also do a lot of online courses, a lot of them free or ongoing, and there's lots of things you can download from my website, or you can get on my mailing list and get blogs from me. There's lots of ways to get involved.
Okay, and where are you located? If someone wanted to take a class, what city?
Well, I travel all over all the time, so my home base is California in the San Francisco Bay Area, but
okay.
On the road, I probably teach out of state more often than I teach here.
Okay.
So
well, if you're ever down
is...
in Southern California, let me know.
All right, I will. Where are you?
I'm in Venice Beach.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I may
okay.
get down there and do something at the at Michael Beckwith's Agape.
Oh, Agape. And when I wonder if you know about the Goddess Temple down in Irvine.
I do not.
Yeah. It's been there 10 years now, an actual brick-and-mortar goddess temple. Founded by Ava Park, and it was actually in my book one of the 108 sacred sites. You know, we don't have many, but we do have one down in Southern California. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. Befitting.
Oh, I would have to see that.
Yes, most definitely. If happy to connect you up with Ava and the priestesses down there. You have to take a look. It's an incredible place.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much for your time tonight, and thank you for your wisdom and insight. You know, definitely very valuable. Thank you for your work in the world, Anadea.
Thank you for yours, Karen. It's much needed. Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, listeners, I want you to remember I won't be with you next week. I'm going to be away from the computer for vacation, much-needed vacation since my husband had been sick. We both really need to de-stress and try to catch our breath. So please check out the archives. I'm sure there's lots of shows you've not had a chance to hear yet, just some of them lately in case I haven't been listening real regularly. Starhawk was on recently. We talked about the need for peaceful resistance and where she's at with her movie of her book, The Fifth Sacred Thing. Garnet Schulhauser was talking about how you can find your spirit guide in the most unlikely of places. His was a homeless fella. Susan Hawthorne called in from Australia, and we talked about the politics of patriarchy in academia. Sabina Magliocco, an anthropologist, was talking about pagan fundamentalism. Peter Lavanda, we talked about tantric temples and the magic in Java. Carl Coleman, Christian mysticism. Malgorzata Peralba talked with me about black Madonnas and dark goddess archetypes. I even did a piece on embracing the other and goddess notices. So there's lots there. And Don Traxler was talking about Maria D. Naglowska. She was a Russian mystic and early feminist who was very much into erotica and sex magic, but sex magic from the point of how sex can actually be used to uplift humanity and help people actually, you know, connect with one another, you know, sex from a very heartfelt place. Also, I want to make sure you know about the conference that's coming up in Malibu, the Goddess Conference. It's bringing together internationally renowned goddess scholars, authors, ceremonialists, artists, musicians, everyone who loves and lives the goddess. It's called the Goddess Spirit Rising Conference, and it's September 6th, 7th, and 8th in Malibu. We have people coming from all over the United States. It's a three days of over 40 workshops, ceremonies, offerings. It's set in a glorious setting right there on the beach in Malibu, complete with their own goddess conference temple, vending hall, nice lodgings and meals. You might recognize some of these names. The concert they're going to have on Friday night features Jennifer Berezin, Anique Radianheart, Judy Piazza, Kathy Jones is coming in from England, Sandra Romain from Spain, Vicky Noble will be there, Joan Marler, Z Budapest. I'm actually one of the presenters myself. You can go for just the day or you can go for the whole weekend. So if you want to get more information about that, go to goddessspiritrising.com. And let me just let you hear from Joe Carson.
The psychic state is the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet. It's called the chthonic mind, the mind of the earth.
Our ancestors understood that the animal and the divine were all connected. They were together, that there wasn't a separation. And that's what we are trying to return to, is that sense that our animal nature is divine. It doesn't get in the way of the divine. It gets us closer to it.
What's your idea of being fully alive as a human being? Because that's what's really spiritual. Write it down. Start writing your own Bible if you want.
Sex is sacred. And by that, I just mean sweaty, fun, happy sex.
Well, that was some of the sounds from the trailer for Dancing with Gaia, a feature documentary about earth energy, sacred sexuality, and the return of the goddesses Gaia. It's a sincere and beautiful film that goes deep into the connections between these important topics. And the DVD comes packaged with a 45-page mini book that expands on the material in the film. And you can get it at dancingwithgaia.com. And I want to thank Joe Carson for having me run these commercials, because it actually helps me pay to keep Voices of the Sacred Feminine on the air. As listeners may know, it does cost me money to keep Voices of the Sacred Feminine on the air, and I'm always appreciative when listeners send in contributions to help me continue to do that. Also, I wonder if you heard my third book, Goddess Calling, is being published by John Hunt Publishers, and it's going to be out in early 2014. So I'll be talking a little bit more about that as in the coming months. It's actually inspirational messages and meditations of sacred feminine liberation theology. Also, too, I wonder if you know about Femme the movie. It's actually called Femme Women Healing the World. Finally, a documentary that addresses the issues of patriarchy, of women's rights, of our desperate need for partnership. Femme Women Healing the World is a brave film that starts at the beginning, unafraid to talk about pre-patriarchal times when women and goddess were revered and people were more concerned about the we and the us instead of the current climate of greed and selfishness, the I and the me. Femme is unafraid to examine the relationship between religion and the oppression of women and the economic disparity that is the result of our following a patriarchal or male-dominated agenda. Well, there's going to be screenings of Femme throughout the month of September. There's also the opportunity to have your own screening in your own town. And you can find out more about that if you Google Femme the movie or go to the website Wonderland Entertainment or WonderlandENTGroup.com. There's information about hosting your own screening if there's not one nearby. So I would definitely encourage you to do that because this is vital information that women and men need everywhere. This is like our continuing education. This helps us evolve and grow. It helps people understand how things have gotten so turned on their head and what we must do to shift things so that we might evolve. And, you know, the message is what, you know, we have been talking about tonight, what we talk about all the time. You know, in Anadia, Judith was just talking about, you know, how do we merge the masculine and feminine? How do we have whole brain thinking so that we can, you know, live in a world without domination, so that we can live in a world of love and caring and sharing, a world where we are more concerned about our personal development than our greed. So anyway, you get the idea. But Femme Women Healing the World, please look into it. There's some trailers on the internet you can find. If you find you can't, please go to my Facebook page or email me at KarenTate108@ca.rr.com. I am happy to point you in the direction to see the trailers and get more information in order to maybe do a screening or suggest your community church or group do a screening. And, you know, the holidays are around the corner, believe it or not. It is going to be here before you know it. I hope you'll think about my books or goddess greeting cards or the sistrums that we sell on my website. I am still trying to sell out my book, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations. You know, I think it's a great book whether you're an actual or armchair traveler. It teaches about goddess spirituality and goddesses while taking you across every continent, exploring goddess culture in the past and traditions that are still alive today. Then my second book, Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth, well, it's divided into the sections that reflect the elements. Spirit is about how someone like me from the Christian bubble actually becomes a goddess priestess. The Earth section talks about experiences on sacred journeys or our pilgrimages. The Water section is about doing ritual and our emotion and connecting with goddess, you know, feeling her. Fire section is about tenacity and the politics, and I talk a lot about the goddess Sekhmet, who is our archetype for female empowerment. The air section is about being inspired by goddess, hearing her whispers to fulfill our destiny, and hearing her sacred roar, and doing what we're called to do in this life. So I guess I just want to say as we come to the close of tonight's show, I want you to remember something very important, lest we never forget. I believe it's important to repeat and punctuate again and again. You know, we are the cognitive minority, just like the scientists who are trying to convince medieval Christians and the church that the world was not flat and the sun did not revolve around the earth. You know, we have an important message with the sacred feminine ideals of liberation theology. And as Gandhi said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. And I believe that's what we're in the process of doing. So please, listeners, check out my website. I'm available to come give a talk to your group or teach a weekend workshop. There's lots of free stuff there, meditations you can download, classes on my YouTube channel, articles, lots of great resources. Excuse me. You can learn about my two books or check out the stuff on the Goddess Store page. And please also to keep in mind what Mother Nature teaches us, what we nurture and tend to survives and thrives, and what we neglect withers on the vine. In fact, that's true for every facet of our life, whether it's our health, our work, our passion, our love, our family. What we neglect withers, and what we nurture survives and thrives. Well, I think that will bring things to a close for tonight. I will be back with you week after next. Ava Park will be with me. We'll be talking about mistresses. Then with Janet Bennion, she's a scholar who has studied feminist polygamy, I believe it is. So we're going to be talking about that. Actually, very interesting stuff. So that's going to be August 29th, the day after my birthday. So thank you so much, listeners, for tuning in every week. You are the gas in my tank. And as I close tonight's show, I think I would like to play something by Zingaya. I think in honor of Sekhmet, our goddess of female empowerment, I'm going to place the Sekhmet mix by a group from Las Vegas called Zingaya. Please enjoy. Hear your sacred roar.
Desert, heart, fire.